Here they come. Right now, they're gathering from hospitals all across America for Talk 10 Tuesday. They know there's important news and information just ahead. Don't miss out. Come in, sit down, and log on. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and co-host Dr. Erica Reamer. Here now is the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clark Anthony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 435th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and brought to you today in part by ICD-10 Monitor. And joining me as my co-host is the exceedingly popular Dr. Erica Reamer, and as you know from listening to Talk 10 Tuesdays, Dr. Reamer is the one, founder, two, the president of Erica Reamer, MD, Incorporated. Good morning, Erica. Welcome back. You have been missed.
I missed you, too. Good morning, Chuck and everyone.
Our lead story this morning is actually, it's an update. It's an update on a previous story we reported back in July. Actually, July 28th, my birthday to be exact. On that broadcast, senior healthcare consultant Deb Greider reported that she had been infected by the deadly coronavirus.
Yes, I remember her, and she talked about coding sequela for COVID-19.
You're absolutely right. Deb is here with us today with an update. She's going to tell us about some of the other conditions that have developed since being infected.
That's right, Chuck. About 1 in 6 people who have survived COVID-19 are expected to have long-lasting complications, long haulers, some of which are life-threatening.
Ooh, I know. And I speak for so many of her fans and her readers and her colleagues when I say how grateful I am that Deb Greider is doing so well.
And me as well. We'll have to ask her about antibodies.
Speaking of which, microbiologist Julia Brode is with us today. She's going to report on antibodies, which, as you know, have been in the news lately concerning President Trump.
And Lori Johnson has the coding report. She always has a coding news story.
Indeed, she does. And our good friend Shannon DeConda returns with an update on the 2021 Evaluation and Management Guidelines.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that. Nice to have Shannon back with us.
It is indeed. And you have a talkback segment this morning. What is on your radar screen?
Chuck and Ron Hirsch, I'm going to weigh in on hypercoagulable state with atrial fibrillation triggered by a conversation I saw on LinkedIn.
Very good. Looking forward to hearing your segment, Erica, very much. We have much news to report, and we begin this morning with Tim Powell, who's at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk is sponsored by ICD University Bookstore, reminding you that Dr. Erica Reamer's ICD-10 flowcharts provide quick guidance to the correct diagnosis codes for potential COVID-19 cases. Use the ICD-10 Monitor Resources tab at the top of the web room for more information.
Here now is Tim Powell.
Thanks, Chuck. And as soon as November, after the election, the Accountable Care Act, or ACA, could be struck down by the Supreme Court. In the first major case against the ACA, the issue was the individual mandate that required people not getting insurance to pay a penalty. The penalty flowed through and was paid on individual tax returns. In a 5-4 decision, the court held that while the federal government could not charge a fee for a behavior, the individual mandate was really a tax. In the 2012 case, NFIB versus Sebelius, Justice Roberts was the swing vote on upholding the law. In 2017, while the Republicans held control of all three branches of government, the individual mandate was repealed by Congress. In the last 4 years, numerous attempts have been made to repeal the ACA. Over 70 times, legislation was introduced to repeal it. Not only did the votes fail, no alternative has arisen to take the place of the ACA should it be struck down. In the current case, California versus Texas, the plaintiffs argue that without the individual mandate, all other aspects of the ACA lack authority and can no longer function. Now, the impact of striking down the ACA in its entirety in broad strokes would be 8.3 million people would lose their health insurance, 15 million people enrolled in Medicaid would lose their health insurance, lifetime caps on benefits would return. People would no longer be able to cover their children up to the age of 26 on their policies. And all ACA reform and oversight regulations would be eliminated. Now, the Supreme Court could narrow a decision by removing provisions requiring the mandate. It would almost be certainly remanded to a lower court. The plaintiff will almost certainly argue in this case that substantially all of the ACA requires the mandate. Well, the defendants will argue the ACA is already functioning just fine without it. Now I'm only offering personal opinions and observations. It seems illogical to argue that the ACA can't function without individual mandates because it is functioning without an individual mandate. If the taxes from the mandate were required to fund the ACA, the system would have crashed when the mandate was repealed. I think a particular concern is a polarization of the court and the healthcare debate in this country. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert and an ICD-10 Monitor national correspondent. It is Tuesday. It's October the 13th, 2020, and you're listening to the 435th live edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
Many coders and clinical documentation integrity specialists struggle to identify the clinical indicators required to qualify a diagnosis as a CC or MCC. Adding to the confusion are ongoing changes to official coding and reporting guidelines and to the coding clinic for ICD-10 CMPCS. Missed or misreported CCs and MCCs pose significant threats to revenues and compliance. Documenting kidney injury, malnutrition, and certain types of congestive heart failure are particularly challenging, and they're audit targets. During an ICD-10 Monitor webcast, Dr. William E. Hake will take a deep dive into targeted CC and MCC areas for 2021 and highlight opportunities for improvement. Join us for this important webcast, Keys to Capturing and Validating 2021 CCs and MCCs. The program is October 28th at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register now.
Here now with the Talk 10 Tuesday Coding Report is Lori Johnson. And good morning, Lori.
Good morning, Chuck. And good morning, Erica. And happy Health Information Professionals Week to our listeners. I was having a difficult time deciding what to talk about today. My considerations were external cause codes because today is the 60th anniversary of the Pittsburgh Pirates' win over the Yankees in the 1960 World Series. And then I thought about COVID, but we're already covering that topic. And then I thought about HIP Week, and we are celebrating the fifth year of ICD-10 CM and PCS. I thought that it would be appropriate to review the ICD-10 CM chapter mnemonics with you. So here we go. Chapter 1 is A and B, and it's advancing bugs, and it's for the infectious and parasitic diseases. Chapter 2 is C and D, cancer and death, for the neoplasms chapter. Chapter 3 is D, for, and then we have Dracula, for diseases of the blood and blood-forming organs. Chapter 4 is E, endocrine, nutritional and metabolic diseases. Chapter 5, letter F, Freud, for the mental, behavioral, and neurodevelopmental disorders. Chapter 6, I took a little license with this one. The letter is G, and I used jittery, but I spelled it incorrectly as G-I-T-T-E-R-Y, and it's for the diseases of the nervous system. Chapter 7 is H, and for hyphema, for diseases of eye and anexa. Chapter 8, hearing, diseases of ear and mastoid process. Chapter 9, infarction, diseases of the circulatory system. Chapter 10, J, just gasping, for diseases of the respiratory system. Chapter 11, K, not in stomach, diseases of the digestive system. Chapter 12 is L, lipoma, for diseases of skin and subcutaneous tissue. Chapter 13, M, musculoskeletal, diseases of the musculoskeletal system. Chapter 14 is N, for nocturia, diseases of the genitourinary system. Chapter 15 is easy, it's O, and it's obstetrics. And the chapter is pregnancy, childbirth, and the puerperium. Chapter 16 is P, perinatal, for certain conditions originating in the perinatal period. Chapter 17, Q, quirky, congenital malformations, deformations, and chromosomal abnormalities. Chapter 18 is R, for relative symptoms, and the chapter is symptoms, signs, and abnormal clinical and lab findings not elsewhere classified. Chapter 19 is S and T, simply traumatic, for injury, poisoning, and certain other consequences of external causes. Chapter 20 The letters are V, W, X, and Y, and the mnemonics are vehicle, whoops, exposure, and Y. External causes of morbidity is the chapter. And chapter 21 is Z, zero problems, factors influencing healthcare status in contact with health services. And this year we added a new chapter, which is chapter 22, and those codes start with the letter U. And I use the mnemonic of unusual. And these are codes for special purposes. And that's the end of my fifth anniversary celebration of ICD-10. So back to you, Erica.
That was really fun. Thanks, Lori. I wish all our listeners happy HIP week, too. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC.
News of President Trump's therapies for his coronavirus infection have included references to antibodies. So what's the therapeutic role these antibodies are playing in helping the president? Well, joining us now is scientist, researcher, and educator Julia Brote. Julia, what's going on here?
Thanks, Chuck. Let's try and shed some light. The term antibody has entered our mainstream vocabulary due to the advent of SARS-CoV-2 with manifestation of disease as COVID-19. Antibodies are also called immunoglobulins. They are protein carbohydrate structures of five different classes produced in defensive response to a foreign invader. Each class binds to alien structures responsible for inducing a host reaction. The basic unit for each antibody class incorporates a constant portion, a structural part that does not change, and another region that is variable. This variable region enables antibodies' abilities to recognize and attach to various foreign invaders, or antigens. Over a lifetime, each human encounters many types of antigens, ranging from allergens to toxins to various microorganisms, including viruses. Humans produce white blood cells called B cells, which mature into plasma cells that produce five classes of immunoglobulins. Antibodies may interfere with infection through virus-specific methods of neutralization. Examples include blocking virus attachment to the host cell, preventing viruses from entering the cell, clumping of multiple virus particles, disrupting reformation of virus particles, and others. Antibodies are grouped into two primary types, termed monoclonal or polyclonal, thus be differentiated by methods through which they are produced. Polyclonal antibodies are generated in living animals from multiple B cells. Thus, the antibodies are heterogeneous in nature. They identify and react to various sites or epitopes on the antigens. Conversely, monoclonal antibodies are created artificially and propagated in tissue culture systems. They are derived from identical B cells called clones, which originated from a single parent cell. Therefore, monoclonal antibodies possess an ability to recognize the same epitope on an antigen and specifically bind to that one site. The process to produce monoclonal antibodies starts with an injection of the desired antigen into a test subject, usually a mouse, with repeated antigen injections encouraging an immune reaction. Once the animal develops a response to the antigen, B cells are isolated from the test subject's spleen and fused with myeloma cells, creating immortalized B cell myeloma hybridomas. These hybridoma cells possess the ability to grow continuously in tissue culture while producing antibodies. Next, the cells in culture are screened for production of the desired monoclonal antibody, which binds with the antigen of interest in the desired region. Positive characteristics for monoclonal antibodies include their high specificity for a single epitope, which results in low cross-reactivity, and commercial production of large quantities resulting in highly homogeneous products. Drawbacks for monoclonal antibody generation include a lengthy time frame for production and high costs associated with their development. Regeneron developed two monoclonal antibodies. Each one attaches to a different epitope of the receptor binding domain of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein. The virus spike protein confers binding ability with subsequent integration into host cells via the ACE2 receptor. In phase 2-3 testing, a cocktail of the two monoclonals seems to neutralize the virus's ability to bind, thus decreasing infection. In addition, the monoclonals do not seem to impair normal enzyme binding with resultant cell function for the ACE2 receptor. It is hoped this monoclonal cocktail may prove useful for people with COVID-19 and as prophylactic treatment for SARS-CoV-2 infection. Back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Julia. That was scientist, researcher, and educator Julia Brote. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And thank you again, Julia, very much. And you can read her very fascinating story on antibodies in today's ICD-10 monitor. What do you need to know about the biggest changes ever to the evaluation and management guidelines? Well, that story's next, coming up. This is Talked In Tuesday. It's a broadcast service of ICD-10 monitor. Stand by.
Now there's a powerful 1-2 response to ICD-10 PCS coding challenges. ICD-10 Monitor and MedLearn Publishing team up to help you navigate the complexities and uncertainties of ICD-10 PCS coding for vascular procedures. When you purchase the webcast, Vascular Procedures, Keys to Correct ICD-10 PCS Coding, you will receive at no additional cost the Vascular Interventional Radiology Coding Charts. Vascular interventional radiology procedures are among the most difficult to understand and report, but these 34 electronic charts from MedLearn Publishing contain high-quality color-coded anatomical images promoting a clearer comprehension of many arterial and venous IR procedures. If you also perform outpatient coding, you'll appreciate the CPT code assignments that correspond to each image. This is a limited-time offer. It expires November 30th and is not valid with any other discounts or special offers.
The 2021 Evaluation and Management Guidelines are said to be the most extensive overhaul of the E&M codes in years. And, of course, the new guidelines become effective January 1st, 2021. Here now with our Talked In Tuesday focus is Shannon DeConda. And, Shannon, good morning. Hey, so many changes. What do we need to know?
You know, Chuck, that's a great question, and one I hope that so many people are asking right now. Based on the rumbles in the healthcare industry, it seems that most are beginning to plan on a rollout for training on the guidelines and the changes, but I've not heard as many comments regarding the creation and implementation of a revised and updated E&M policy for 2021. And of course, every organization needs to have some type of an E&M policy. I mean, it's not like you can take the AMA guidelines and slap an implementation date and a policy number and make those your guidelines. Why? Just as with the previous guidelines, there are a lot of gray areas and holes that still exist that need to be defined by your organization for continuity of coding, auditing, and of course, documentation. As a reminder, we have discussed before that we have at this time are the AMA guidelines. Now remember, the AMA creates codes and descriptions based on work involved with the service description and does not address reimbursement policy. Admittedly, most carriers have not yet released specified payer policies and therefore lacking in the creation of a policy. So when you write your policy, you won't have that carrier-specific guidance. But please don't let that be the reason to procrastinate this daunting task. Creation of a draft policy with a reasonable approach to the points of concern with the guidelines will begin a constructed policy that will merely need to be revised as opposed to recreated. I thought today I'd give you a couple of examples of areas in which defined internal policy will ensure your team has the same approach on interpretation of those new guidelines. So first of all, we know in 2021 it'll be time or MDM. For 2021, the rules are clear on that fact that we won't use history in exam, but rather MDM and time. How will your organization handle encounters in which time and MDM are both documented? Because there's a lot of controversy right now, as a lot of coders think the minute they see time that they have to use time. For example, a provider documents that 40 minutes was spent with a patient, but the problem was a chronic stable problem with a medication refill, which would score a lower level of service. Should your team choose the lower level of service based on the MDM or go with the time that supported the higher level of service? Your policy should address the opinion of your compliance department. By the way, there is no rule other than if you can support it, then you bill it. So if the documentation can validate a need for the 40 minutes based on the complexity of the presenting problem of that chronic stable problem, then you could support the higher code. But without written guidance, this may become a confusing point for your team. One area of great many arguments for E&M services has centered around prescription drug management for years. And some carriers and MACs have created reimbursement policies specifying an interpretation of that. It would have been great if AMA had addressed this concern, but it was not included in their defining terms. Your organization should include directive on the interpretation of prescription drug management within this policy, which would be, by the way, considered the initiation, modification, discontinuation, or continuation of any prescription drug medication. We also have this whole thing about the history and exam. If we don't have to score history and exam, should your organization continue to solicit that information from providers? And of course, the answer is yes. There are many other gray areas that we've been working hard on to spotlight through the NAMIS emails and audit tips. It will be imperative for us to all keep our ear to the ground and keep tuned in, as we only have 79 more short days until we go live. This means we only have 11 more Talk 10 Tuesdays, Erica and Chuck, before we have that official implementation. So it's time to put hard work into the policy to ensure seamless implementation and get your organization ready to go. Right, Erica?
Yep, you are totally right. Thanks, Shannon. That was Shannon DeConda. Shannon is the founder of the National Alliance of Medical Auditing Specialists, or as we know them, NAMIS. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Shannon, nice to have you back. Once a frequent flyer, senior healthcare consultant Deb Greider was abruptly grounded when COVID-19 curtailed her coast-to-coast consulting. She first reported on her sequela from COVID-19 for Talk 10 Tuesdays listeners back in July. She joined us now to report on several other conditions that have arisen. And good morning, Deb. Welcome back. So the first question, how are you doing these days?
Thanks, Chuck. I'm doing much better. I'm starting to recover nicely. Not to say I don't still have signs and symptoms. I still have, you know, some shortness of breath, bouts of fatigue, sometimes fog brain, not, you know, it's intermittent. I do have still coughing a little bit, and so I do have some of the sequela effects of COVID-19. Don't know how long it's going to last, but I do feel much better. And, you know, I pray for everyone out there who's suffering from it, the sequela events as well as active COVID. So it's really a horrible condition to have, whether it's mild, moderate, or severe. So when we're talking about the people who survive COVID-19, we're calling them the long haulers. And interestingly enough, I ran across a study from IU School of Medicine, which is where I worked for many years. And it's called, it's a symptom survey report that was created by a Dr. Natalie Lambert at IU. And it entailed a forum that was founded on Facebook. And it was for people who had related sequela symptoms of COVID-19. And it's very interesting because they had over 1,500 respondents. And this actual forum has grown, and there are other forums out there for people who have sequela. But some of the conditions that we're finding can be long-term. Some do affect other organ systems. Some may be short-term. Some may be We don't know. So this is something that we don't know. So what this survey said is that some of the symptoms are painful. About 26.5% are painful symptoms, like joint pain, chest pain, for example. And then they have painless symptoms out there, such as things like fatigue and aching, shortness of breath. Those are typically painless symptoms in some cases if they're not severe. So when looking at the survey, it's very interesting. And I wrote an article that should be on the ICD-10 Monitor website with links to some of these resources that I've been using. And I've been keeping up with this because I am very invested in the sequela to COVID-19. Fatigue is top on the list, and muscle aches, shortness of breath, difficulty concentrating, and I have all four of those symptoms still. And I had contracted COVID in late February, early March. So it's been about 8 months, 8, 9 months now, and it's been a long haul. But some of the less conspicuous symptoms are things like congestion, runny nose, sadness. PTSD is a big issue, depression. People feel isolated. I myself do not go very many places, and I always wear a mask. That's important to protect yourself and others. I'm always washing my hands. I have hand sanitizers in my handbag and all over my house, so, you know, constantly sanitizing. And yes, I was a frequent flyer, and I actually had one business trip in early March, not early March, but in early September, and I was very concerned. I was going to a rehab hospital in Michigan, but I did not feel unsafe. They took all the preliminary precautions. All the physicians in the room and the other practitioners in the room wore masks. Everybody was 6 feet apart. The hotel we stayed at was very clean. And, of course, I brought my Lysol and hand sanitizer, so I'm cleaning everywhere. But you have to protect yourself. But some other conditions we're looking at are things like sore throat, night sweats, tachycardia, hair loss, ear pain, ear loss, tinnitus. Those are other ones that we'll see. And just to name a few, but this study lists all of the different conditions that are in this report. The other thing to keep in mind is that when you're coding sequela to COVID-19, make sure that you identify all the conditions, as I said in my earlier report in July to COVID-19. Code first that the conditions you're treating, and then B94.8 is the sequela code that we use from a diagnostic perspective. When it's documented that they have that condition, either by testing or in the physician's documentation to confirm. If you're not sure or the physician wasn't sure whether it was COVID-related or not, you code first the conditions you're treating, and then you report the Z86.19, which is the personal history of the infectious or parasitic diseases. So lastly, we have to make sure that we're paying attention and using caution and wear your mask. So back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Deb. That was Deb Grider. Deb is a senior healthcare consultant with Karen Zipko and Associates. She's also an author for the American Medical Association. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica, and thank you again, Deb. Be sure to read her article on her remarkable journey in today's ICD-10 Monitor. And now it's the time for a very popular segment here at Talk to Tucy. It's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, it's all yours.
A while ago, Alan Frady and Dr. Ronald Hirsch were having a lively discussion on LinkedIn regarding atrial fibrillation and the diagnosis of D68.69, other thrombophilia, which is the code used for secondary hypercoagulable state. I thought I was going to be able to weigh in quickly and decisively, but I exceeded my character limit, so I had to bring the decision here, this discussion here. Primary hypercoagulable states are easier to identify. They are hereditary abnormalities of coagulation where a physiologic anticoagulant pathway is not properly functional. Examples are antithrombin 3 deficiency, protein C and S deficiencies, and dysfibrinogenemias. The checks and balances of clotting don't work, so the patient clots excessively. There are conditions of acquired hypercoagulability, which are referred to as secondary hypercoagulable states. Examples of this are pregnancy, hormonal therapy such as birth control pills, malignancy, and hyperlipidemia. Alan questioned whether we are missing the diagnosis of secondary hypercoagulable state in the case of atrial fibrillation. He referred to a presentation by Dr. Vladimir Ducarmel-Joseph, who referenced Virchow's triad and posed atrial fibrillation as being a hypercoagulable state. Since AFib affects approximately 1% of the population, Alan wondered whether we are missing a prime opportunity to capture D68.69, a comorbid condition or complication, or CC. Virchow's triad is a pathophysiological concept to explain an increased likelihood of developing thrombi. The three components of the triad are stasis or abnormal blood flow, endothelial injury, and hypercoagulability caused by abnormal blood constituents. The more factors the patient has, the higher the risk of developing a clot. The title D68.69 is Other Thrombophilia. Thrombophilia is defined in the Merriam-Webster Medical Dictionary as a hereditary or acquired disorder marked by an abnormal increase in the tendency of the blood to clot and higher than normal risk of thrombosis. It is a well-known complication of atrial fibrillation for patients to form clots, usually in the atrial appendage, and for these clots to be propelled into the brain circulation causing stroke. The risk is about 5% per year on average. The older the patient, the higher the risk. Patients are often placed on anticoagulation prophylactically. They have a higher than normal risk of thrombosis, but thrombi are not forming on the basis of an abnormal tendency for the blood to clot. My opinion is just having a propensity for developing a clot, especially in a specific location, does not constitute a hypercoagulable state. Thrombogenic, yes. Hypercoagulable, no. Having an injury or a previous DVT does predispose a patient to developing a clot. That is not a hypercoagulable state to me. I think the key question is the patient generally predisposed to a clot anywhere in their body because their coagulation system is not functioning properly? The higher than normal risk of thrombosis from other thrombophilia is due to an abnormal tendency of the blood to clot, not situational. Patients with atrial fibrillation don't have blood with a higher tendency to clot. The provider does a risk-benefit analysis and renders their blood less likely to clot with extrinsic anticoagulation. Should the provider be documenting all pregnant women, all patients on hormones, all patients with malignancies with D68.69? Not unless they are taking those secondary hypercoagulable states into account and assessing or treating it. The condition must meet the criteria of a secondary diagnosis. As I think about everything nowadays, what about COVID-19? Experts are not sure of the mechanism, but the coronavirus does seem to make some patients hypercoagulable. They have a tendency to develop clots in various locations. This does legitimately meet secondary hypercoagulable status. The key is, how did the provider document it? Are they treating with anticoagulation? I think this is query-worthy because, epidemiologically speaking, knowing the incidence of hypercoagulability in COVID-19 would be important. My vote is atrial fibrillation is not a secondary hypercoagulable state. There is literature that refers to it this way, but prepare yourself for a denial appeal, unless there are extenuating circumstances. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. And that's going to be a wrap for our 435th live edition of Talk to In Tuesday. And I want to thank our panelists today, Julia Brote, Shannon DeConda, Lori Johnson, Tim Powell, Dev Greider, who reported our lead story, and of course our co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. And one more thing before we go, the presidential election is coming up November the 3rd, so if you haven't already, today might be a very good day to register to vote in the upcoming election. And remember, you can listen to all the Talk to In Tuesday podcasts anytime on any device, anywhere. It's free. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk to Tuesday. Thank you for being with us, and be sure to wear your face mask, wash your hands, and practice social distancing. It's dangerous out there. Take care, everyone. Be safe.
Talk to In Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.